for the staff is so constructed that it can not only conduct the rays but also transmit them in a transformed state, amplified or diminished, at will. Hence, an initiate doesn't need to enter the divine state of being in order to conduct the highest radiation of life into the Ark of the Covenant. On the contrary, he can enter a lower state of concentration and then direct the power corresponding to this level into the Ark of the Covenant, after raising it with the help of the staff up to the level of creative energy. When the Ark is charged in this manner, it radiates for a long time this highest and strongest energy, as a source of all other forces on Earth. An initiate can produce and control even the most varied frequencies with the staff, as the staff is an Ark of the Covenant in miniature form, except for the fact that creative energy is not stored in it as in the case of the Ark of the Covenant. With the help of the staff, a human being could even convert his lower powers into creative force if he could radiate in a pure, positive and completely selfless manner power that is several octaves lower. This is because the staff always radiates the power that a human being puts into it. If a primitive and selfish person were to get possession of the staff, he would transmit his own negative radiations arising from his selfishness, possibly even in amplified form, and thus cause sicknesses, epidemics, earthquakes or even greater destruction as the necromancers and practitioners of black magic once did in the home of a divine race. Do you understand now why the initiates keep their science so secret from the uninitiated? I understand, Father. And it is now quite clear to me how my father revived the half-dead boy. In his state of high concentration, Father directed his radiation, in magnified state, into the child. It worked like a miracle. The child was charged with vital energy, and his exhaustion disappeared immediately. But, Father of my soul, what is going to happen when the sons of Min take over the government? Are you going to destroy the magic staff, as Father said, when he told me the initiates are going to destroy all their instruments? What a shame that people won't be able to enjoy the blessing of these powers. My child, says Tahotep, every creature lives in conditions that are exactly adapted to its state of development. If we were to betray the secret of the staff to the sons of men, they would immediately use it to do harm to each other and to themselves. The sons of men aren't ready for this knowledge and won't be for a long time to come. The staff we are now using will be taken out of Egypt by the last initiate in possession of the secret knowledge, along with the Ark of the Covenant. He will have no possibility to build a pyramid. On the contrary, he will make a small cover for the Ark to insulate it as well as possible. He will charge the Ark to a much lesser degree and will cause it to be carried during his migrations by means of long wooden poles as handles. When this last initiate feels he is approaching death, he will destroy his staff. For a time the Ark will continue to radiate the energy with which it has been charged, and the uninitiated will continue to carry it about in various countries for a long time until little by little they notice that it no longer has any power. Then even the last remains of the Ark will be destroyed. In times to come people will learn about the magic staff and the Ark of the Covenant only through records of earlier times. They will consider all this as a fairy tale and continue to tell it from one generation to another. But they will still vaguely remember that once there was an Ark of the Covenant in which there dwelt the power of the living God. And they'll also remember there was once a magic staff, or as we call it, a staff of life, with which the initiates, the magicians, performed miracles. From records from earlier times people will know or dimly sense that the staff represented power over all forces of nature. In later times when people want to symbolize the greatest power, they will place a staff, a scepter, in their hand as a token of power. In those times to come, however, their staff, their scepter, will only be an empty symbol of power. The true power said force of the staff will no longer be known to them. Only after thousands of years will a descendant from the tribe of the sons of God be reincarnated. He will discover these truths for the people of his time and will make a new magic staff. Until then, however, for thousands of years, there will be a strange kind of people who, either to entertain or to cheat, will call themselves magicians and will pretend they are performing their magic tricks with the help of a magic wand. They will thus be imitating what once actually existed. They will hold a magic wand in their hand and go through the motions of drawing magic powers from this wand. They will also use magic words, imitating our magic formulas. But people will only learn the true gigantic power of the word centuries later, when the fallen members of the divine race are reincarnated, those who are now living here, and will remember in their subconscious the truths which in that time will represent ancient records. They will prove that their memories are correct. The time will come when the sons of men rediscover and repossess all knowledge, even the very highest. Even then, of course, this knowledge will remain an unintelligible secret for the ignorant masses, and in uninitiated hands these rediscovered truths will be a curse. But after all, this is the path of mankind, through many troubles and sorrows, which people make for themselves. Little by little they will learn they must not play with divine power. They'll come to know that these powers should be used in full seriousness with dignity and dedication. For God gives mankind all, even himself, as a blessing. Only people, in their ignorance, make a curse out of everything. Father of my soul, I ask, you said that the pyramids were made of thick blocks of stone in order to insulate the equipment by means of which the penetrating frequencies are radiated. But how then can you conduct the radiations to the outside? The thick walls of the pyramids all contain shafts and tunnels through which we conduct out the force of the Ark of the Covenant and the other supplementary equipment which radiates energy. With the aid of these shafts and tunnels we also control weather. The positive and negative tunnels are built in different directions. When the positive and negative forces flow through them, they cause clouds to form and bring about the desired rain. The equalization of these tensions causes flashes of lightning accompanied by great noise. That is why people hear thunder coming from the pyramid. The other pyramids have been built for various other installations. What's going to happen to the pyramids when the sons of men come into power in our country and the Ark of the Covenant and all other instruments are destroyed? Will the pyramids stand empty? And what's to become of the high priest and the other priests and initiates? I ask. All except for the largest pyramid where the Ark of the Covenant is now kept and where initiation is given, the pyramids won't remain empty. When all our instruments for the radiation of divine creative energy are removed, the last initiated pharaohs will have themselves entombed in one of these pyramids. Their bodies, permeated through and through by divinely creative force, will continue, as the force will not be consumed, to radiate the supreme power just as the Ark of the Covenant does. Thus their bodies will continue in secret to act as tremendous sources of power, protecting this continent from evil influences. The radiation of well-preserved and holy bodies will help our country keep its power for thousands of years. But in the course of time most of these tombs will be destroyed by ignorant people. And what's going to happen to the Great Pyramid, Father? Tahotep looks off in the distance for a while as if he were observing things there. Then his heavenly glance sweeps back to me and he says, when the time has come for all secret instruments to be destroyed, and when the priest and initiates still serving in the temple at that time take their pilgrim staff and set out for faraway places, the high priest and his deputy will close the rock entrance of the Great Pyramid from the inside so that no son of man can find it. Then, after fulfilling their last duties, they will dematerialize their own bodies in just the way you've often seen the offering on the altar in the temple court dematerialized. Just a flash, then a little white cloud that soon disappears, not a trace of ash or anything else remains behind. Thus the interior of the Great Pyramid will be closed off from human sight for thousands of years. Nevertheless, our initiations will not cease. Mature souls will continue to be initiated here, not physically, of course, but on the higher spiritual plane. These people will experience their initiation as a dream or a vision. Tahotep ceases speaking, and for a long time we look into each other's eyes. I understand a lot that he doesn't want to say. But I still have another question, Father of my soul, is there a special reason why all pyramids are built in the same form? Why aren't they built in a cubic shape, for example, like other buildings? Tahotep smiles, not in cubic form? But the pyramids are built in cubic form. But I'll have to explain that to you next time. You've had enough today. I see that Tahotep has ended his instruction, but I still remain. I'd like to have him show me the use of the staff and the Ark of the Covenant. He looks at me with a smile and says, the time will come when you'll be permitted to know about the construction of the Ark of the Covenant and the Staff of Life. That will come after you've been initiated. But the use of these instruments is restricted to those who've reached the seventh degree after initiation through their own efforts. These secrets must not come into dangerous hands. Be patient. Time exists only in our thinking, but still everything takes time to mature. He blesses me, and I leave. The form of the pyramids, Satan. Once again I stand before Tahotep in his laboratory. I've already explained to you, he says, that behind all the manifestations of the visible world there is a primordial force, a striving to return to the state of unity, and this force is apparent as the attraction between the two complementary halves, the positive and the negative. You are now standing before me because the Earth's gravitational force is holding your body here. If it weren't for this force, you and everything that is not rooted to the Earth would have spun off into space long ago. Even the whole gigantic body of the Earth would have broken apart long ago. The force which holds together the Earth and all the matter within its atmosphere doesn't belong to the Earth itself, but merely affects the Earth operating outward from its center. If matter had no resistance and merely yielded to this force, the tremendous mass of the Earth and everything that's living on it would disappear into its center. But where would it go? Think for a moment. Come closer, my child. I'll show you. If I put various things on the top of this table, tie a string onto each, draw the strings through the hole in the middle of the tabletop, and then pull all the strings from below, all the objects are drawn towards the center of the tabletop, and all those that are smaller than the hole disappear. Where do they go? Aren't they drawn towards the point from which the force is acting? But where does the force in the center of the Earth come from? The force that draws everything towards it? Can you answer that, my child? I reflect for a moment and answer, the Earth is recognizable. If everything that is recognizable is so only because it has separated itself from the all and nothingness, leaving its complementary half behind in the unmanifested state, then the Earth too must have its complementary half in the unmanifested state, and the force of gravitation it exerts on all the creatures and objects living on it is the striving for reunification between the Earth and its unmanifested complementary half, which has been left behind in the void as its negative reflection. The Earth's gravitational pull thus draws all the Earth towards the void which stands beyond time and space, in order to bring about this reunion. If the Earth were to yield, all the Earth and everything on it would disappear into the center, into the void. But that would be a return to the paradisiacal unity, to God, to bliss. Why can't that happen, Father? My child, answers Tahotep, the obstacle is the resistance of matter. Without resistance no creation is possible. It's the resistance of matter that keeps the Earth and all creation from disappearing and being annihilated. Everything that has appeared in this recognizable world has fallen out of a point in the universe, and this point has then become its own center. Through the fall it became matter. Now it can't return to divine unity because its own resistance as matter doesn't let it. A return to the paradisiacal divine unity, to God, is only possible through the spiritualization of the matter, that is, through the transformation of matter into spirit. But matter, all by itself, could never become spirit without spiritual help. That's why one aspect of God comes down into matter, clothes itself in matter, assumes material characteristics, and animates it as the self in order to make possible its spiritualization. Its salvation. The effect which this self in the center of every creature has constantly exerted on the innermost structure of matter throughout eons and eons of time has led to the development of the forms of life existing on each rung of the ladder of creation. Thus each creature has come into being, from the simple protozoa up to the highest manifestation. The highest creature on earth is man. It is his task to carry out the completion of the spiritualization of the earth, a task at which all living creatures are at work, each within the limits of its own particular stage of development. And every human being who transforms himself from a being identical with the body into a being reawakened in spirit, a divine being, identifying his consciousness with the divine self, has fulfilled his duty. He has spiritualized a bit of the earth. He has advanced by one step the salvation of the earth. Then he can cooperate as a helper in the salvation of other beings. And now you know why you're standing here before me. It's because the self of the earth, which at the same time is our own self, loves the earth and all its creatures, drawing the earth towards itself, into divine unity, just as a bridegroom draws his bride to himself. This striving towards union, characteristic of all love, expresses itself in everything, including our bodies, as weight. This force which we call weight is at work in every form of nature, and when we build we must reckon and work with this force, never against it. When we take proper account of it, it helps us preserve our buildings for a long time. If we were to try to build against the laws of these forces, all our structures would collapse in practically no time at all. It's enough for you to understand that in the pyramidal form the resultant of forces is the most favorable one possible for the preservation of buildings for many thousands of years against the ravages of nature. The pyramids, particularly the Great Pyramid, have been built according to various mathematical and astronomical laws in order to serve the people as clock and calendar. You will learn these laws another time. Moreover, the fact that the lateral faces stand at an angle of 51 degrees to their base enables the pyramid to reflect the sun's rays far out to sea and far into the desert. Thus our pyramids also serve as lighthouses. All the laws on which they are based, together with the history of those who have built them, are inscribed on the ceramic dials with which they are covered. When the sons of men someday discovered the secret of our writing, they will be able for a long time to read-write from the pyramids themselves the knowledge and information I am giving you now, the mathematical and astronomical laws we have applied, the secrets of the pyramids and all our scientific knowledge. In the darker stages of the earth, however, these written records will also disappear, so the sons of men will later have to discover all truth for themselves. You must learn the law of the three-dimensional world, which is based on the law of the spirit and could not exist without it. The first source of all truth and of all manifestation is the eternal being, God. But God is in the unmanifested state beyond time and space, and only his manifestations appear as projections in the three-dimensional world. Therefore, in order to understand these laws correctly, we must begin with God. In order to talk about God, however, we always have to cope with the fact that God stands above the recognizable world. For this reason, every living creature can only understand God to the extent to which it itself is able consciously to experience, manifest and realize God, that is, to the extent to which it itself can be God. In everything God is living, and everything is living in God. Nevertheless, God in his own complete, perfect being can be understood only by one who has himself become God, or who has never fallen out of God. God can be understood only by God. The fact that even the most primitive man has a concept of God shows that divine consciousness is dwelling within him, even though only very dimly and to the lowest degree. On the other hand, to become conscious in God, to understand God completely, and to be God means to become completely one with one's own divine self, with the God dwelling within. That is easy to say but very hard to do. Because man has fallen out of his divine consciousness, he can only imagine God in accordance with his own personal power of understanding. How can he know what the real, Living divinity is like in its perfection when his power of imagination only corresponds to the level he personally stands on, separated as he is from unity, and having fallen as he was from divinity. How can the finite understand the infinite, the mortal the immortal, the temporal the eternal? How can an imaginary being understand, experience and become identical with the eternal, true being, God? And still man must reach him. His eternal desire, his unquenchable longing helps him and propels him forward in the direction of his divine self. Man's intellect, the greatest but most dangerous gift he has received from God, builds a bridge across the seemingly unconquerable chasm between that which is personal and mortal and that which is impersonal and eternal. Through man's intellect he succumbed to the temptation to fall out of divine unity with his consciousness. But by the same token, his intellect gives him the possibility of bringing back his consciousness into full union with divinity. By means of his intellect, man is able to understand truth, and when he is understood, he will seek and keep on seeking and trying until he someday succeeds in finding the only path to the realization of his self. Realization means being something. For as long as we think about something or talk about it, we aren't being it. You can think about a cat, or about a lion, but that doesn't mean by any manner of means that you have achieved realization, that you have become a cat or a lion. Likewise, you can think about yourself without being your divine, creative self. To think something is to be separated from it. For if you send out a single thought, you, the thinker, are connected only by thinking with the object of your thought. You are connected with it, but not identical with it. You are not yet that which is in your intellect. Your intellect belongs to you. It is a wonderful tool, a mirror into which you can project everything and in which you can recognize everything, but your intellect is not you. The intellect is outside yourself. Consequently, what you can do with your intellect is not you yourself, is not achievement of realization. When man seeks God outside himself, he can often be thinking about God, he can be praying to God, he can be loving God with his whole being, but all this doesn't mean he has become identical with God. For man can never find God by seeking outside himself. The creator in man is man's own self, whose last manifestation, farthest from his own center, is his little I, his personal I consciousness. The personal I within him is the image of God mirrored by matter, in the body. Thus, when man seeks to return to God and re-establish his identity with him, he must follow the same path with his consciousness. He must draw his consciousness more and more from his own little personal I deeper and deeper into himself, turning to his own true self, to his creator, until he consciously recognizes himself in him. But this doesn't mean that the creature, the person, recognizes itself in this condition. As an imaginary being, it has no true existence and cannot really achieve self-knowledge. On the contrary, the creator recognizes himself in the created, in the person. This is the only possibility for overcoming the state of separation and bringing back the consciousness into the state of unity. The individual stops thinking about himself and instead becomes himself, recognizes himself. In this condition, the recognizer, the recognized and the recognition are one and the same. The self, the creator, recognizes itself in itself. Man can only experience God in this way. This is resurrection. In this state he recognizes that his own self has created him and is constantly creating him, hence that his own self is his creator. He likewise realizes that the one and only self is the creator of the entire universe. As a result of this divine self-recognition, he simultaneously experiences the creative cosmic all-consciousness. At the same time as he achieves self-recognition, he achieves recognition of everything, omniscience. This divine state in which the creator recognizes himself may also be expressed symbolically by numbers. God in his state of resting within himself is 1 in 3 and 3 in 1, 1 and 3 are still an unseparated unity. In the field of geometry, the form of the equilateral triangle is the symbolic image of God in which the recognizer, the recognized and the recognition are 1 and the same, 1 in 3 and 3 in 1. Every form is the manifestation of the force that has built it. Thus every form is the image of the creative force that builds it and dwells within it. Divinity in its primordial state of resting within itself, always manifests itself in the form of a triangle. The triangle represents perfect harmony and perfect equilibrium as its three corner points all lie exactly the same distance from each other. On the other hand, when the aspect of God to which we refer as resting within itself moves out of the dimensionless state, beyond time and space and into the three dimensions, it becomes the creative aspect of God and always manifests itself in the number four. As long as the numbers one and three form a unity in divinity, they remain three in one and one in three. But when they emerge from the divine condition of unity, they separate, and out of the one in three there emerges one and three, and that makes four. The equilateral triangle contains, hidden within itself, four smaller equilateral triangles. This law also contains the secret of the key number of the three-dimensional world, the number seven. Now try to imagine how the first energy of manifestation emerges out of the dimensionless state into the three dimensions. Close your eyes and I'll project this truth into your consciousness. I do as Tahotep tells me, closing my eyes and turning my attention inward. All of a sudden I see a point, and I hear Tahotep's voice, in order for a force to emerge from the dimensionless state and manifest itself, it needs a point of departure. A point is dimensionless, has not yet emerged from unity, but is necessary for manifestation. Because a point consists of only one single factor, it bears within itself the number of unity, the number one. When the force whose first manifestation was a point emerges from the dimensionless state and is effective for a period of time, the point moves and forms a line. With my inward eye I see how the point gradually becomes a line, and I hear Tahotep's voice. The first dimension, length, is born. In its essence, the line is endless and thus, as a first manifestation, also represents the number one. But in the world of manifestations, the world where everything always has a beginning and an end, a line is always bound to involve three factors: its starting point, its end point, and the intervening space between the two. Thus the line represents the number three, the key number for the one-dimensional world. Now you must have noticed that there is no possibility of manifesting or of finding the number to inner unity. As a matter of fact, after the first manifestation of the point, which represents only one single factor, we immediately jump to three factors, without the number two. When a point moves, no matter how little, to form even the tiniest, shortest line, we're already dealing with the three factors, not two. A line in infinity, of course, represents the number one, but when it has a beginning and an end, it automatically represents the number three. In order for the number two to arise, there has to be a splitting of unity. The number two can only be born when two units are set beside each other. But inasmuch as nothing has any real existence outside unity, unity must project reflection outside itself. Thus there arises a fission, a separation, which means the death of unity. That's why the word for doubt, which represents a kind of cleavage within one's mind and soul, is so closely related to the word for two. This is true in every language. Let us now watch how the second dimension arises from the first. A line consists of a series of points. Assuming the creative energy is active in each of these points with the same force and for the same period of time, each of these points moves outward from itself into the second dimension, each of them becomes a line, and out of the totality of these lines a plane is created, an equilateral rectangle. The second dimension, width, is born. The rectangle is 4 in 1 and 1 in 4 and thus consists of five factors: the four manifested lines, line of departure, terminal line, right and left lateral lines, and the fifth factor, the non-manifested area enclosed by these lines. And so the key number of the two-dimensional worlds is the number 5. But creative forces continue to work. The plane also consists of points, And if the same force works outward from each of these points in the same direction and for the same period of time, all these points move into the third dimension, and a cube has been created from the plane. The third dimension is born, height. The cube is 6 in 1 and 1 in 6 and it consists of 7 factors, the 6 manifested limiting planes and the 7th, unmanifested factor, its cubic contents. The key number of the three-dimensional world is the number 7. As you see, the basic form of matter is the cube.